This is Rumblestrip, good conversation that takes its time. I'm Erica Heilman. And this is the sound of my mother's house and Lake Champlain in the fall here in Vermont. I've been living with my mom for a couple months at our camp where I spent whole summers as a kid. And I've never been here this late in the year, and it's beautiful. And it's also sort of eerie, which in a way was the perfect setting for this conversation with Susan Randall. A couple weeks ago, Susan came out to visit me here. She's a private investigator, and we've been friends for 30 years. Every few months, Susan and I get together and we compare notes on our lives and on what the hell is going on. I think that's the thing that Susan and I share the most, is this central question, what is going on? So we get together periodically and we see if we can make any headway on that question. And I record these conversations because the sound of friends you've had for 30 years has a certain sound to it. Anyway, Susan has had a rough year. She's had medical issues, there was a death in her family, and the Trump administration has complicated her work, to put it mildly. So she came out and we sat on my mom's screened-in porch and we talked. Here's some of that conversation. Welcome.
Yeah, so I lost my dad and lost my right breast and lost my mind a little bit with grief. Yeah. I had 5 years with no breast cancer. And then I went in for my yearly MRI in November. So that was rough because my dad died November 3rd. And then I had my MRI on November 11th. And it came back with this like 3.5 centimeter string of cancerous cells. And I get this phone call from the breast care center and they're like, "Hi, is this Susan Randall?" And I was like, "Yeah. So your biopsy came back positive for invasive ductal carcinoma." And I was like, I mean, it sort of sounded like it was like, "Oh, you just won a dishwasher." Like, it's like, what? Why are you so chipper? Like, this is terrible. Does this mean that I actually have cancer again? Yes, it does. You probably need to get a mastectomy. You know, and I like the girls. I was like, oh, you know, you have certain parts of your body that you like and certain parts you're like, that could go. I always have liked my boobs. And I was like, oh, this is terrible news. You not only have to go through menopause and get like a double chin and like wrinkles on your lip, have fat arms, but like now you're going to like take my boob. And at the end of the day, I was pretty cornered. It was like, people who want to live, get a mastectomy. And now I'm kind of like, thank you, right boob. Like, you totally took one for the team. Like, you, I mean, I didn't get out unscathed. I have like a big scar, but like, I didn't have to get chemo. I didn't have to get radiation. I had all this dread around coming out of surgery with this scar. And then the incredible part about having a mastectomy is all of a sudden you look like you did when you were 10. And so all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I loved her. It was pre-pubescence. It was pre-boobs. It was pre-boys. It was pre-alcohol. It was pre, it was just like you feel like scout. And so it's actually been this amazing thing. Now I have like half of me is my 10-year-old self. And then the other half of me is like the one that had boyfriends and kids and like these boobs that had a great time and got to like nurse babies. And so that whole thing, when you look at photos of yourself and you're like, God, I look terrible. I look at photos of myself and I still look terrible, but I'm like, whatever. And it's genuinely like, whatever. Capital W, whatever. And what a gift. What a gift. I mean, people spend like years in monasteries trying to get there. And I just had to spend like a day at Sloan Kettering.
Can you talk a little bit about what is happening with work right now, you know, in the last year?
I mean, 30,000 foot view right now with criminal defense is that they are ramping up prosecution. They are wanting to execute more people on death penalty cases, and they are simultaneously underfunding and defunding defense. So this year, Congress did not approve enough funding to get us through the year. So the fiscal year ends on September 30th, and back in like May, June, July, we started getting these notices where it's like, we're out of money. We're just out of money. And we're all sitting there going, what do you mean you're out of money? We have a judge court-ordered approval to pay us for our work on this federal case, this federal criminal case. So we then get this message in all of our inboxes that just says, oops, sorry, out of money. All that work that you just did. And for many people, it's the matter of like, are you going to stay in business or not stay in business?
So that's investigators, that's attorneys, that's paralegals. Who you know?
Yeah, so when you're working on a big criminal case, you're paid with a certain bucket of money that comes from the federal government. Congress has to vote about how much money you get. And what happened with the Trump administration and with this Congress is they just didn't approve enough money. And they simultaneously are doubling down and prosecuting more and asking for more harsh punishment. So at a time when we really, really need excellent, smart young people that are graduating from college and law school to go into this work and do capital defense work, the people that are in that world who are standing there with an approved budget from the judge are not being paid. I'm being told, oh yeah, you know that $65,000 of work that you did where you hired subcontractors. So we're talking investigators, mitigation specialists, translators, paralegals, learned counsel, local counsel are just being told you're just not going to get paid for the next 4 months. What that means is that you don't have qualified people who are going to be defending people at their greatest moment of need when the federal government is saying, we want to authorize the death penalty for this case, for this case, for this case. And everyone's like, well, I still didn't get paid on the last five cases that I worked on, so I can't take your case. It'd be like if you hire a plumber to come fix your sink and he has to wait 17 months to be paid. The next time you call him and your toilet's flooding, he's not coming. Picture this, and this was my case this spring. You're sitting at MDC Brooklyn. You just found out that your case is death penalty eligible under the Trump administration. And the two white guys in the cell next to you have just been pardoned from their January 6th insurrection. And you're facing the death penalty. And you're just the next day being told that you're not going to get a visit from anybody on your team, even though you're in solitary, because none of them are getting paid. So everybody on your defense team has to pivot and do other work, privately paid work by wealthy people. So I'm seeing on these listservs, these requests going out for people to come into capital defense work, there's sort of like, oh my gosh, if they're gonna be trying to prosecute and execute people, we need competent people who know how to do death penalty work. At the same time, they're being told they won't be paid. So it's a crisis.
There is always a challenge, I imagine, a challenge of getting people to care about criminal defense funding. I mean, what if somebody says, who cares?
I think it's always fascinating when you have a family who has a child who is wrongfully accused of a crime and has a false allegation, and they've always believed in the police, they've always believed in prosecution, they've always believed that he's our president and I may not have voted for him, but you know, I'm gonna get behind him, and suddenly their son has a false allegation for whatever reason. Or their sister's daughter is accused of something that she didn't do, and they don't have money, and they're not going to like refinance their house to pay for a defense attorney. A murder trial, a sex assault trial can cost upwards of $200,000. Those people suddenly really, really care about criminal defense. So all you have to do is be falsely accused and you really care.
Even if you're not falsely accused, you just need a good defense.
Absolutely. I would say 80% of the time on criminal cases, something happened. It may not be exactly what the person's being charged with, but there's all kinds of mitigating circumstances that need to be investigated about why it happened and how it happened and whose version. So if you completely defund the people who allow you to have your day in court and you don't have anybody investigating what actually happened, you basically warehouse poor people because they can't afford to ever tell their story.
There's no value put on everybody has a right to an attorney.
So we might as well just kill the poor. I mean, what's happening right now is it's like, well, okay, snap, oops, we're just going to get rid of nutritional programs that we took years and years and years to develop. Let's get rid of all the needs on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like food, housing, and school, because we don't like poor people. This is the message, is like, we don't like people of color. We don't like people that are poor. We don't like people that are handicapped. So let's just lock them away, defund everything that we developed as a society to help them. I mean, my friend from Kenya, like right after Trump got elected, my friend Angie called me from Nairobi and she was like, yeah, now we're all in the same boat. You guys just stood right over the toilet and just chucked your democracy right down the toilet. So this is going to be looked back on as a 200-year experiment. You know, she said, my mother was hungry during the Mau Mau Rebellion. It's very, very vivid how many people, you know, people don't give you an inch. You don't just give rights. Lives were lost. Blood was shed for women to get the vote. People had dogs sicked on them and were lynched and hung from trees to get their civil rights. And we have failed to hold the line. We have failed to hold the line for those people that lost their lives, in the Second World War, that lost their lives, suffragettes, that lost their lives in the civil rights. We need to hold the line. We need to tell our kids to hold the line, that we don't allow ourselves to just be our most base, greedy, selfish, AI-generated selves.
We're the same age, you and me. And one of the things that I've been around family a lot in the last few weeks, and I noticed that my mom, who's in her mid-80s, who I've been living with, which has been great, and she's moving into different mystifying stages, all kinds of medical things, balance, hearing, you know, things are hard on a physical level. And I see her, you know, sometimes we're sitting around a big table and there are all the kids are around and the kids now are in their 20s and they're talking really fast. And I can tell that there's a lot that she's not catching. And I can also tell that it doesn't really matter, that she's not hung up on it. And because she's grown out of that, being hung up on it. And so, and I can't quite understand that because I'm not there yet. But then I also notice that the kids, our kids, they keep being a step ahead of you in terms of parenting is always, you're always chasing it because it's always changing. And it doesn't signpost, it just changes. And one of the things that I'm noticing now is that, you know, particularly with my own son, the only thing he really needs from me now is to get out of his way. We love each other, but what he most needs from me now is to let him move on. You know, now I understand, it makes me realize, it makes me understand better why old people love to give kids candy. They love to give kids candy, and they love to say, oh my God, I noticed that you liked that stupid knick-knack on the shelf. You here, have it, you should have it. And it's because you want to give them something. You want to keep being useful. And it's not that you're clinging to them. It's just that you have spent a lifetime. You know, you've spent 20 years meeting their needs. And to suddenly reach a point where what they really need is for you to just stop trying to meet their needs. It's a challenging stage. It's a humbling stage.
Humbling is an understatement.
That was a conversation with Susan Randall. If you have comments or suggestions about the show, you can email me at rumblestripvermont@gmail.com. Rumblestrip is an independent podcast distributed on the radio by Vermont Public. I'm Erica Heilman. Thanks a lot for listening.